Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Stepan Mestrovic. Stepan is professor of sociology at Texas A&M University. He's also the author of The Good Soldier on Trial, subtitle, A Sociological Study of Misconduct by the U.S. Military Pertaining to Operation Iron Triangle, that was in Iraq. We've talked about the book before on this program, and we've talked about how the chain of command, the ones responsible for the serious crimes that America commits, I live here. Stepan lives here as well. We live here, but we'll talk about they, because we certainly don't commit these crimes, but they commit them all the time. They commit more of them. They send out these innocent young men and women under rules of engagements, like in Iraq, saying shoot or kill all military age males, which basically means license to shoot anybody in sight. And then occasionally something causes a little commotion, stirs up some dust, and some lower-level soldiers get hung out to dry for following orders of their commanders, even though they're illegal orders. They face a Hobson's choice. They can either disobey them and end up in the brig very harshly, like Bradley Manning, or they can obey them and hope that somebody will not accuse them of a crime, which, of course, it is, but it's the commanders responsible for the crimes. It's the commanders all the way up the chain of command through the Secretary of Defense. I call him the Secretary of War because that's what he is. The top brass in the Pentagon, and obviously the President of the United States, no matter who he is. Am I angry about this? You bet I'm angry. Stepan, I welcome you to the program. We want to talk about the latest things you've been involved with. Stepan?
Yes, hello. Sorry.
Oh, did you catch all that?
Yes, I did. Good morning.
Good morning to you. I welcome you back. It's wonderful having you back on again. You've been involved in a lot of this personally. Let me let you explain what you've been doing and the important cases and so on.
Well, let me begin by adding to what you just said. Shortly after President Obama ordered the Navy SEALs to kill Osama bin Laden, I talked with William Hunsaker, who was the main protagonist of my book. I talked to him from Fort Leavenworth, and he had an interesting thought. He and the other soldiers there, who are there for various war crimes, they said that mission, which everybody celebrates, is exactly the same as his mission, with the difference that everyone's celebrating the killing of Osama bin Laden, and they're in jail. And what they meant was that, technically speaking, when the Navy SEALs went in, they captured Osama bin Laden and killed him, which is technically a war crime. Now, of course, nobody regrets it and nobody should, but my point is that in the larger context, these kinds of search and destroy missions, whether they involve real soldiers or whether they involve unmanned drones, this kind of stuff goes on all the time, and yet these low-ranking soldiers, usually, I think, for reasons of making a political impression that America has rule of law, so it uses these soldiers as an example. These guys go to jail. So it's really historically an interesting way to look at it, that you know, the soldiers who are in Leavenworth don't see a difference. And I think they're right in the larger philosophy of waging the war that's going on and that's approved and what they did. So from that point, the latest case I was on involved Jeremy Morlock and what's reported in the news as the kill team killings in Afghanistan. And again, it's very similar to what happened in Operation Iron Triangle. The killings I'm talking about occurred late 2009, 2010, where you had a group of about five soldiers killing Afghan civilians. Jeremy Morlock admitted it. He pled guilty. He was sentenced to 24 years. He has regret. But the thing that came out interesting in the investigation was that the brigade commander, Colonel Tunnell, had a philosophy very similar to that of Colonel Steele, who was involved in Operation Iron Triangle. It was basically a lethal philosophy, which was strike first and ask questions, if any, later, but certainly not to capture. You know, the motto of the brigade was strike and destroy. It was called Striker Brigade and was to strike and destroy. So this kind of lethal philosophy of going after the bad guys and eliminating them coexists very unhappily with what's known as the coin doctrine, counterinsurgency doctrine, or winning hearts and minds. The winning hearts and minds part, just like in the Vietnam War, seems to be kind of an afterthought, something that's put in toward the end to for public relation purposes. But the basic philosophy is very lethal, and like you said, these young soldiers are rotting away in prison for decisions that are made by our generals and by our politicians.
Oh, absolutely, Stepan. And, of course, we're waging these illegal wars. It is absolutely illegal to enter another country, a phrase that I've used a couple of times, enter another country guns blazing. Who gives us the right to go into any of the countries we're bombing and occupying and so on? Who gives us the right to go into Pakistan for any reason or any other country? We're now bombing Yemen. Even the New York Times reported that. Amazing.
Right.
I mean, they try to hush this stuff up. But they're bombing them. The use of drones, Stefan, I refer to that as droning. I use that word in one article. And I like that word. I'm going to talk about droning, and maybe others will pick it up. I mean, that's what it is. Droning, of course, means bombing the hell out of people illegally. That's what droning means. Not just bombing them, but bombing them illegally. That's what it means for me. And we're doing this. And I just wrote an article about use of drones, Stepan. I learned. I got an email this morning from a friend telling me about a third location where they're being sent out from computer screens, control rooms with soldiers or whatever, operating these multiple screens and pushing red buttons. But that's basically what it is. Halfway around the world, you've got soldiers, and I wrote about the ones at Creech Air Force Base in Nevada, close to Las Vegas, and the CIA has its own at its headquarters in Langley, Virginia, and you've got these people, CIA, I guess, civilians, Air Force people, trained technicians, and they sit there at these multiple terminals, and they're watching these stuff like playing a video game, and they're homing in on targets with all the technology they have. Again, multiple screens, and they can zoom in and do all kinds of fancy things. But again, it's like kids playing a video game, and they push a button and bleep. Some blip on the screen obliterates. How lovely. And then they go out to lunch, or they go home at the end of a long day at the office, Stepan, and relax doing whatever. And they're committing war crimes every single day. I wonder if they think of it that way. Do they really think they're serving their country? I mean, it's astonishing. I know brainwashing is a powerful tool, but people do have a mind of their own, at least a little bit. Don't these people ever wonder that, who gives us the right to do these things? Who gives us the right to say these people are our enemies? Have they attacked us?
Yeah, I mean, I want to say a couple of things about that. One is that the actual physical live soldiers have been reduced to drones because there's really no difference in the lethal philosophy whether you use a machine or you use a soldier to perform these missions. So you are reducing, dehumanizing the soldier on the ground to do this similar kind of thing. Two, you know, as you know, when you read about some of these strikes by the mechanical drones, there's a lot of civilian casualties. You know, they talk about how they targeted the bad guys. They're never sure that it's the bad guy because somebody gives them the name. Sometimes that's a revenge by various tribes or groups in that country, Iraq or Yemen or Afghanistan, for settling old scores. But a lot of times women and children are there as well. That shows up in the news all the time.
Yep, and you, third, you know what the error rate is? And that was in my article. The error rate is 99%. And the figure that I quoted was that of every so-called militants killed, 50 civilians are killed.
Wow.
Isn't that astonishing?
And it is astonishing. And of those civilians that are killed, there's going to be desire for revenge, hatred for the United States, and a whole new crop of people who will rise up against the United States in the future. So it's very counterproductive as a philosophy. But what's interesting is the government talks about winning hearts and minds through, you know, doing projects in agriculture, building clinics, bridges, roads, etc., at the same time that it's following this lethal philosophy. So, you know, there's just some vast contradictions that are going on there. But to answer your question directly, you know, do any of these people think about what they're doing, that these are war crimes? Well, certainly Jeremy Morlock does and William Hunsaker does. The soldiers, the low-ranking soldiers I've talked about, they do think about it. They definitely think about it. I don't know what the generals and the colonels think, but the low-ranking soldiers are quite aware that this is wrong. There's something totally wrong with the system, but they're compelled. I mean, the thing that I bring out in my book about William Hunsaker is when they spared the lives of the people they were supposed to kill. They took them prisoner. Instead of being rewarded or being told, good job, guys, you know, it was kill or capture, you captured them. No, instead the first sergeant gets on the phone and says, why do you have any prisoners? Why do you have any prisoners? And so, you know, they're pressured into committing the war crime.
That is really stunning. That is absolutely stunning. And yet I know, Stepan, that the training these soldiers go through, they're taught to vilify the enemy, hate the enemy, think of them in terms of vermin to be exterminated.
Yes.
So, you know, I mean, you kill an Iraqi or an Afghan or whatever, and, you know, I mean, you're improving the quality of life on Earth by doing this. And of course, you've got these young kids, some of them are teenagers, and they're more impressionable than older folks who've been around and seen
absolutely
a few things.
So young.
Oh, they're so young, and I have to believe that probably most of them go over there thinking they really are serving their country and doing the right thing.
Yes.
And if the commander, you know, this wise colonel or whatever, he's been around, if he really tells me to do something, well, he just may know. So it's a good thing that I'm doing what he tells me to do.
But sorry for interrupting, but just to add to your thoughts, there's a systematic way that the Army training now goes about to make them into killing machines. There was a study in World War II by a man named Marshall called Men Against Fire, and what he found was only 20% of U.S. soldiers in any battle or engagement, only 20% would open fire. In any battle, the other 80% would freeze or not open fire. So the Army realized that was a problem in World War II, that basically people don't want to kill. Even soldiers realize that killing is an abhorrent act, and only 20% of them would do it. So they tried their best to raise that percentage. In Korean War, went up to 40%. In Vietnam, it went up to 60%. The latest studies, because they've got these techniques now, are that 90% will open fire, because what they do is they give them seminars and training. There's a book out there called On Killing, which they have PowerPoint presentations on. In Hunsaker's unit, The book was actually purchased for them by the brigade commander and issued to every soldier. And if you read this book, it's basically a how-to manual. It tells you very bluntly, never hesitate, never feel guilty, never look back, never feel bad. If you see some commotion, open fire. Again, it's a lethal kind of philosophy. Ask questions later. So it's done very systematically. These soldiers are turned into killing machines in a very systematic, organized, thought-out, planned sort of way.
I didn't realize that some of those materials existed. I was in the Army in the 1950s after Korea and before Vietnam. There was none of that going on when I was in the service. Now, one
right.
war had ended and the other one hadn't begun. I mean, it was percolating beneath the surface because they never end. There's always conflict going on. And, of course, the Korean War never ended. There was a quote-unquote an armistice. We're still
right.
technically at war with North Korea. Astonishing.
Right.
And no matter how hard they try and want to normalize relations with Washington, we flat turn them down. And the axis of evil syndrome. Well... when it comes to the evil empire, there's only one evil empire. There's only one evil empire in my mind that ever existed, and that's the one, unfortunately, that we happen to live in. I mean, what other country wages wars across the world, one nation after another, and heaven forbid a war end, well, or heaven forbid an enemy disappears, you need to find a new enemy. So we keep inventing them. We turn former allies into enemies, whether they be good guys or bad guys. People like Saddam Hussein,
right.
Gaddafi. I mean, you go one after another.
Bin Laden also. He was an ally of the United States.
Oh, he was a CIA asset. CIA asset. In fact, he was, once he was recruited in the 1980s, he never lost that status. I don't know just what his knowledge was about consorting with the CIA. He did it through the Pakistani ISI, their intelligence agency. I don't think Bin Laden would be too happy being called a CIA asset.
Right.
Oh, my goodness. But I've said this and I've written it that America doesn't have allies. America has interests. And today's ally could be tomorrow's enemy if it serves America's interest. And the rule of law doesn't matter. The only rule is this is what we want and this is what we're going to get. And we're going to do anything that we have to get it. And the major media go along with this stuff. They mischaracterize, in plain English, Stepan, they lie calling these imperial wars liberations or whatever language they use, humanitarian intervention. I mean, that would be a sick joke if so many people weren't being harmed so grievously. I could go on and on.
No, I agree. Something is definitely wrong. And again, from my work, working with the soldiers, I get a real feel for what it's like for them to be in these units. And for these young Americans who go in there patriotic, I mean, I can just characterize it in the following way. They're broken when they go in through boot camp, which is pretty much normal even when the time you were in the Army. But then they're broken again with these kinds of training programs to turn them into killing machines. And then once they comply with that and they're put on trials, and they're put in Leavenworth, they're broken again by being put into solitary confinement, which is a standard procedure now. I mean, again, I don't think people realize that your welcome to Leavenworth is they immediately put you into solitary. That's how you get there. That's called, the orientation program. Orientation program is not like, well, here's where you are, here are the counselors, these are the things you can do to rehabilitate yourself. No, you put into solitary. They break you. Same thing happened to Jeremy Morlock. He's not at Leavenworth yet. He's at the regional facility at Fort Lewis. The moment he was convicted, they threw him into solitary. In fact, they put him into a shed with no ventilation, no heating. He was freezing at night. I wrote to the commanding general, and I pointed out, we don't even do that to animals. If you leave an animal, a dog, in an unventilated space, or a child, the police will be after you, but we do this to human beings. He was freezing at night. I wrote the letter in March. They never resolved the situation, even though I try to alert them to it. So it's a constant dehumanization, not only of the enemy, but I really fear of our own soldiers.
It is shocking and amazing, Step, and a few people know this in this country, and they know very little about the U.S. prison system or the military prison system, and they really both run in a very similar way. The only military prisoners that I've written about, Paul Berggren, and we can mention him again. I think we should during this program. Paul Berggren, who is sitting in a New York City jail facing multiple charges that could put him away for life for doing his job. So they even go after the lawyers. But I wrote two or three times about Bradley Manning and the horrors they put him through, and Bill Hunsucker and the others involved in the Iron Triangle incident. I've written a fair amount about the U.S. prison system, and a couple of times in detail on solitary confinement and what it does to human beings. Very briefly, Stephen, I try to describe it to people this way, and I said something to the effect that imagine if you were confined, say, to your windowless bathroom for 24 hours with just enough food and water to get by, and maybe had a mat to lie down on so you could get some sleep. But you were isolated and you couldn't come out for 24 hours. You'd probably go nuts. And then my next line was, imagine being in there for the rest of your life or for, you know, for years. And I mean, this can go on interminably.
Right.
You could see why this can easily break somebody emotionally, psychologically. They can literally be turned mad going through this.
Right, and you forgot one more important ingredient. The lights never go off. They're not allowed to sleep.
They're not allowed to sleep. And they get awakened. They'll get awakened during sleep.
Exactly. And just basically for sadistic purposes. I mean, no reason at all, supposedly just to check on them. So, you know, they did this to Hunsucker. They did this to Morlock. It's routine. It's not like, you know, they pick on some specific individuals. This is a routine process that people don't know about. So when Morlock testified, as it was part of his agreement against a fellow soldier a couple of weeks ago, the news media noted that he looked terrible. He had bags under his eyes. He was slumping in his chair. He had blurred speech. And, you know, I'm reading this saying, well, ask the next question. Why? Why does he look so terrible? He's sleep deprived. So it's not just totally isolated where your mind basically turns on itself. It's that you're not even allowed the basic human need and function to sleep properly. And then if you go into details about this, if you try to improvise and put a pillow over your head to block out the light, you get points. You get punished for that. They want to make sure that you're suffering from the light being on 24 hours a day.
Well, you have to suffer plenty from what they put you through. And again, I mean, this is another form of torture. So they're literally torturing people, not just the few that occasionally a story comes out about some Muslim militant, they call him, in another country or whatever. But we do it to our own service people, our own military. We do it to political prisoners here in this country. And I've written about dozens of them. I've yet to find one person charged with anything who was not innocent. And we do this routinely, and we have the largest prison population in the world by far, and per capita, off the charts,
Right.
And how many people know about this? And it keeps growing, and it's the prison industrial complex, because there's so much money to be made on it, not just the privatized prison system, which is a small component, a growing one, but small. But all of the profiteers that benefit from the government-run prison system, and towns compete with each other. If a new prison will be built, towns compete with each other to get it built in their area. I mean, that it's almost sadistic to think, we need to create jobs, so send the prisoners in here, and we'll lock them up in this Bastille-like confinement. Again, I say, what kind of people think like this? It's very disturbing to me, very disturbing to me. And it's disturbing, Stepan, to see us not improve things, but the conditions get worse and worse.
Right.
And
right.
It literally doesn't matter who the people are in the power positions, from which party. It seems like each succeeding election we get a new crop worse than the previous one. So it was New Year's Eve in Chicago, the night that Obama was declared the winner back in November 2008. I was not in that crowd, just 2 or 3 miles from where I live, but I certainly wrote about it. And people were so euphoric. It was literally New Year's Eve in Chicago.
Right.
And I had no idea how bad it would be, but I knew it wouldn't be good because I wrote about Obama's voting record in the Senate, and if you just struck out the name and looked at the way he voted, he was like a Republican. And it was disturbing to me, and I said, well, if he did all this as a senator, what on earth is he going to do as president? Well, he was even worse than my worst fears, and it just keeps getting worse all the time, and still too many people believe him. His approval rating is sagging, and I just wrote about that. It's the blip he got from the bin Laden stunt, and I must emphasize it was a stunt. But he got a blip. It wasn't as big as I thought it would be. But he got a bump in his poll numbers. They're all gone now, and it didn't last very long. But he's hanging on. He's not as low as he should be. And I'm just waiting for enough people to realize how bad things are, how bad he is, what he is doing, harming so many people, including U.S. citizens in this country. Then when will his approval ratings get as rock bottom as George Bush? And the only difference between them is that he's smooth in the things that he says, and Bush was a good old boy, crude guy. So if you weren't a good old boy yourself, then maybe you didn't accept that stuff too well. So Bush went out with rock bottom low approval numbers. I still believe that Obama just may get those low approval numbers before he's done. And the only reason I can see that he could be reelected, Stepan, is that the alternative is so abysmal.
Right, exactly.
That, well, my feeling is don't vote.
Yeah, I mean, people will vote because, you know, it's a privilege and it's a right, but I think you're right. I mean, the alternative is also abysmal. But when you look at his record, you were talking about in the Senate, but if you look at it in the presidency, he has reversed and done some things against openness and so forth worse than the Bush administration. For example, he shut down any of the independent investigations and possible prosecutions of the government agencies and civilian contractors who were involved in torture at Abu Ghraib and elsewhere. He simply shut that down. The basic ruling from Holder and from his administration is that those people who tortured believed that what they were doing was right, then they cannot be prosecuted for anything. So, you know, even Bush didn't do that. So basically, we've turned a page on the past 10 years, which is one of all kinds of abuses, and we don't want to look at it. It's a closed book.
Closed book, indeed. The worst of the Bush administration's war crimes. Case closed. We need to look ahead, not back. Was one of the lines, more or less, what Obama said.
Exactly.
On a TV interview, one of the Sunday talk shows, before he officially took office, we need to look ahead and look back. Well, that's exactly the wrong thing to do. If you don't look back and hold people accountable, then looking ahead, you're going to get more of the same, and we always do. Of course, the Democrats were complicit in Bush crimes. That was another factor. I mean, they could have stopped this stuff, and they didn't. They went along with everything and voted for all the hideous police state laws and the wars and the appropriations to keep fighting these wars. And in the last day or two, the Republicans in the House passed a resolution. I didn't read it. I don't know what the title of it is, but basically wanting to shut off the funding for I don't know if it's the funding, but basically condemning Obama for not getting congressional approval to bomb Libya. Well, of course, it's going nowhere. It's one of these acts of Congress where they spout off rhetorically, Stepan, and it doesn't mean a damn thing. I mean, they could stop this Libya war today. Both houses of Congress, they could stop all the wars and occupations today. Just wipe out the appropriations for them, and the wars end, and just leave enough money to get the troops out of there and bring them back. That's how the Vietnam War ended. Finally, the Congress very, very slowly got enough backbone, and they stopped funding the Vietnam War, and it ground to a halt. We could do the same thing with all the wars we're fighting now, but they don't want to do it because they want to keep fighting them, including the Republicans in the House.
Yeah, and of course there's the enormous expense. You know, we're talking about billions of dollars per day, and in a time when the economy is sagging and it's weak, and obviously that money can be used better for domestic projects, and domestic spending is being slashed right and left. So it's really a terrible situation overall.
It's a terrible situation indeed. I just glanced at the clock. We are out of time. But you will be back before too very long, Stepan. So we will continue this. There's so much more to be said. And when we live in a country that every single day without exception, the people who run it commit crimes of war against humanity, then we have an obligation to speak out on this, to denounce it, to urge people not to put up with it anymore, and to have our tax dollars, instead of being used to help people, they go toward killing people. That this is indefensible, and we all need to be aroused enough to want to take it on and stop it. Stepan, I look forward to getting you back again. We'll continue this.
I do too. Thank you very much, Stephen.
Thank you, Stepan. And join us this weekend, of course, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. There'll be more. Lots of topics, all important. Do join us.